You're not human.
That's hurtful. Are you that guy with the evil powers? I think everyone has dark urges. It's kind of my thing.
Welcome, adventurers, to this episode of the He Who Writes with Monsters podcast. I'm Donnie B.
And I'm D. Allen. What is happening?
I don't know. I wanted to go at the intro, so we did it.
I guess we've done it. What? Well, I guess then it's my turn to say what we did last week. So last week, we covered chapters 15 through 17. They trekked through the desert. They went on a little bit of a conservative pillage, and they met back up with Anissa as she was throwing someone out a window.
That's true. That is true. All that did happen. This week, we're going to get into a little bit of the adventure lifestyle. We're going to cover chapters 18 through 20 this time. And where Jason and Rufus have a massive heart-to-heart about him being in this new world. We're going to learn a little bit more about the magic system, kind of break down how magic works here, and lead up into what essences are, and into Jason's essence rituals. So let's kick it off.
My dude, before we kick it off, you are the magic system expert. I want to see some excitement about this, man. This is a big moment for you.
Yes, it is. I am very excited.
No, I know you're excited. You're just a very reserved guy, and that's all right.
I'm trying to save all of the excitement for the exciting bits. This is just the recap, dude.
That's fair. All right. Well, to get right into it, we have ourselves a moral dilemma in that after they've raided and pillaged this manor, Jason asks them, like, well, what'd you do with all the cultists you found? And Rufus says, matter-of-factly, we killed them.
Right. Yeah, this is one of those moments that pops up, one of our big themes for this first really three-book arc, you know, because in Rufus's world, in Palamustis, you know, the standard is there's a bad guy. You know, we found the bad guys, we questioned them, we got all the useful information we could, and then, you know, execute prisoners. It's just what you do, you know. It's like everybody's powerful, everybody can be bad, so we don't want them to be a problem anymore. And, you know, I believe Jason actually curses at the end of this chapter, probably for the first time in the book, I think, towards another person. And it's one of those things, it's like, well, you executed prisoners? And Rufus is like, yeah, what else are we going to do with them, you know?
Well, I think something you're possibly missing in that moment, though, Jason actually passes out again.
Not right here, he doesn't.
I want to say he does, because it says he ran a hand over his face, the energy draining out of him. Oh, damn it. I read that as he passed out, like.
No, I read that as, it's like, I just killed everybody and I feel shitty about it. You just killed everybody and that's a standard. It's like, why is this happening again? You know, he's like doing his best to not kill people. And Rufus is like, yeah, we're just killing everybody. It's kind of like when you're playing a game like Overwatch or something, and your healer just runs off and does whatever they want to do.
Right.
And this is the one game you chose not to play healer. And like, you know, that's kind of how I read it.
All right. That's fair. I mean, I think this is a glimpse now. And really Jason's real moment of like, oh dang, like this is real kind of. And we had joked around a couple episodes ago about whether, like, you know, there was, whether, you know, was it real or a dream, the whole dream theory nonsense that you see with a lot of media. But this at least in Jason's case, unequivocally answers for him that it is real. Because there's a stark difference in the cultures and just day-to-day life of Palamustis versus Earth.
Yes. And I actually had that in a little bit later in the chapter here when Rufus and Jason are talking on the balcony. It says, Jason says, you know, the ability to muster even a little bit of logical detachment implies that they aren't the answer. Meaning that, you know, hallucinations and a dream state or, you know, something similar like that couldn't possibly be what's happening to him. Like, this is real life. You know, the only possibility left is a coma. He could be in a coma and just dreaming all this up. And then he goes on to say, you know, even I don't have the imagination to dream all of this up. Yeah, we had talked about that, I think, in episode one. We were talking about whether or not this was a real or a dream. Could have been episode two.
Yeah, episode one or two, we talked about it.
Yeah, and this moment, and with the talk that he's having with Rufus later that we'll get into in just a sec here, I think really proves that this is really happening. This is real, and he is in another world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. But coming around back before we get too far into that, because that's a whole conversation in that, just that conversation between Jason and Rufus. So at the beginning of the chapter of chapter 18, like, they're in the house and kind of just getting themselves cleaned up. And in yet another interesting description of his scenery, the kitchen of these cannibals, where they're at in this cannibal mansion right now, the kitchen, in Jason's mind, he figured it was going to look like some medieval fantasy, probably a cauldron over a fire pit or some, you know, some grotesque prison-y thing. But what he finds is literally just a modern kitchen, because they've used magic to implement similar things that we on Earth did with technology, just with magic. So he just finds basically a modern kitchen, but like also like a Rob Zombie film. You know what I mean? Like, it's just absolutely blood and gore everywhere, grotesque.
I believe it specifically reminds, or Jason specifically mentions, that it is stuff of nightmares. You know, it's
right.
It's absolutely insane. You know, and this is kind of where we get our first glimpse into everyday magic too. You know, like you said, it's like a very medieval type world in terms of the way people are and the societies and everything. But going through this house, and even outside the kitchen, you know, everything is as you would see in a modern home. You know, they have showers and they have heating and cooling and, you know, refrigerators and ovens and stuff. But instead of using electricity, they use magic and rituals and arrays to make all of this stuff work.
Right. And I will be honest, this detail that I looked at while reading through for this episode completely floored me, in fact, because overall my mental image of Palamustis is not that at all.
Mm-mm.
Like, it's very much more along the lines of, like, you know, a Elder Scrolls style realm of sorts. And I even though there's a lot of technology and whatnot described, I guess in general, my mental picture of the place doesn't really match that, like, modern feel. And now, like, just looking back, and, you know, I'm going through book 12 right now, and just a couple scenes that I just was reading through today now already have changed in my mind. Like, oh, right, they do have like modern features. So like a couple scenes I'm reading through right now have kind of shifted in my mind, and I'm like, oh, it's weird.
Right. Well, and as I get deeper into it, you know, my perspective of this world on my third or my fourth run through of the series, you know, keeping all this in mind, it's kind of a world where they have the Industrial Revolution and everything is modernized. They have all of these magical rituals for everything that we would use electricity for. Mm. But you don't have the aspects of like globalization and trade networks. So it's like, you know, we're in coming into Greenstone and around the Delta, a lot of buildings are made out of, you know, thatch and grass because wood isn't very prevalent in the area. So they don't have like, they don't have the resources to transport wood all over the world in mass amounts like that at a cheap cost, but they have stoves and ovens and refrigerators and stuff. So that's, I think that's where my mind goes to in terms of the medieval aspect, because all of their buildings are medieval type buildings, you know,
right.
But everything inside of them is like 21st century home. And it's kind of a weird parallel to draw.
Well, and I mean, really, if you put it that way, it really draws an interesting aesthetic in the mind of just this rustic yet modern technological society, but not really technological. Well, I mean, at least not yet, not until Earth influence comes and then they start to get Magitek, but...
Right.
It's
kind of like those videos you see on Facebook where... You know, rich people spend hundreds of thousands of dollars building a home into the ground with like mud and fallen trees and stuff. But the inside of it is like a $1 million mansion. It's got plasma TVs and king size beds.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like on the outside, it's just some kind of hobbit hole or non-copyrighted small people that live in Hillock's hole. but on the inside, it's just a mansion.
Oh, for real. I thought at first, I thought you were going to mention those like dudes in like India or maybe the Philippines who dig like crazy stuff just in the dirt, but they don't do all the like technology and stuff with it. They're just doing like natural water features and like crazy stuff. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. Yeah. Those are really cool.
Yeah. That's what I thought you were talking about at first. And those guys like... That's probably more accurate to what's, you know, maybe Greenstone is like in a way.
Yeah. 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 Like that that show on HGTV where they build tree houses. On the outside, it just looks like a tree house, but on the inside, it's everything you could ever need to live.
Dude. Okay. And like very not related, but tangentially related. For whatever reason, when someone says like treehouse or like living in treehouses, my mind is immediately brought to the Gen 3 Pokemon games, Ruby and Sapphire, and I cannot remember the name of the town right now, but there is a town where it's like mostly water, but the entire town is just in the treetops, and you're just going bridge to bridge, and all the buildings are in the trees. And I would love to, like, find a place like that. That is, like, the coolest thing in the world.
That would be dope. That would be really dope.
Yeah, it'd be so freaking cool. But that's, like, the kind of aesthetic that, like, I don't know, this brings to mind, you know?
Oh, yeah.
It's a really cool, and maybe that's by design, and that, you know, that is a video game, and this is very video game inspired. So it's possible that, you know, that it's an intentional, you know, maybe just like that style is a very video gamey kind of thing. I don't know. Or fantasy kind of thing.
We'll have to ask Shirtaloon when we get a chance.
Speaking of the aesthetics, though, one of the aesthetic choices that Shirtaloon made was for this world to have two moons. And there's a scene here where Jason looks up and he sees one of the moon is full, the other one is a crescent moon. Mm-hmm. And it kind of threw me because it was like, hold up. How in physics is that possible, first off? And second off, what would that do to like the tides?
Right. Dude, I thought about that. I did. And I did a little bit of research into it. And it's still, the physics still don't make sense to me. For those viewing us on YouTube, I can throw up a little image here to help us get a look at it. All right. So this is how the moon phases basically work, right? The only way that this would be possible for the moons to be in two different phases, right? We have a half moon and a crescent moon in this scene. So we have, you see at the top, the half moon is basically right above dead center of the sky here. The crescent moon is, I want to say about 80 degrees off. I didn't get the exact degree here in orbit. So the only way that this would be possible is if the moons are really locked in synchronous orbit with each other, or if one of them is traveling a significantly higher rate of rotation than the other. You know, I really, what confuses me is if it's possible to see this far around the horizon with two moons in the sky, you know, and if you can, then either the moons would be in constant flux of which phase they're in compared to each other, or they would be locked in a synchronous orbit, which would stabilize the tides. The tides would just act weird. Aside from magic, which I'll get into in just a sec here, but you would either only see one moon at a time on average, or when you do see two moons, you know, they're in completely different phases. I don't think it would ever be possible to have both moons in the same phase and be able to see them at the same time, just with the way gravity kind of works. I do recall a little bit later in the book when we meet Clive, Jason asks Clive about the two moons and what that does to the tides. Like, how does this affect the tides? And Clive's like, What are you talking about? And that's when the goddess of knowledge bribes him into not talking about gravity.
Oh, that's right. Okay. So
we never get an answer on that.
All right. On this thought experiment though, now my initial thought actually was exactly your explanation, in that it wouldn't be the idyllic, like, Tatooine two sun kind of vibe where you see a full moon with a crescent moon right next to it. That probably not possible. More than likely it would be one moon way over here in the east, the other one over here in the south, or, you know, some other angle of other option. Unless the second moon is orbiting the first moon and its whole phase and eclipse status is based around the moon that it's mooning.
But that wouldn't make any sense, because the moon phase is based on the amount of sunlight that's being reflected from the moon and reaching us on Earth. All right, so if one moon is orbiting the second moon, then that moon, the both moons would always be in the same phase, depending on where in the orbit the second moon is, because the sun is still hitting the same amount of moon and reflecting back to us. So a full moon on the first moon would look like a crescent moon to us because of our angle of approach with the reflection of the light.
Oh, okay. No, but I think maybe you misunderstood what I was saying. So imagine we have two moons relatively similar, and they're in an, like, one is orbiting the other.
Right.
So here, let's bring up our image again. So you've got, look at our full moon here. Now imagine, right, behind our full moon to the right of the screen here, imagine, mm-hmm, that there's another moon off, you know, maybe to the northeast of it, and the shadow of the first moon is causing a shadow on the second moon, creating a crescent moon to the observer here on Earth.
But it would only create a shadow on the second moon if the first moon is, like, blocking the light, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So the first moon would have to be behind the second moon, in which case we would get a lunar eclipse on the second moon. So, sure, one of them would be red, but you wouldn't have like enough blocking to create like a crescent. Well, it's like if you're standing in the middle of the street, right? You had a street light on one side and the rest of it is dark. If you put one person standing in the middle of the light and you had a second person walk around the first person, right? You would see the shadows move in exactly the same amount. The same amount of both people would be lit by that light to our perspective, right? So person two that's walking around person one would look like the shadows are moving to person one. But from our perspective, it's the same amount of light would be visible on that person from the same side.
All right. So I think here in the future, you and I need to make a practical demonstration of this. We need to make a practical demonstration and show or really see what would happen in these conditions.
Yes. I will go to Hobby Lobby tomorrow and buy little balls, and then I'll just use a secondary light source and we'll work it out.
All right. Yeah, we'll work that out. We'll figure something out. I think it'd be really fun to figure out how two moons on Palamustis might work.
Yes. In the meantime, let's get back to Jason.
Absolutely.
So now, one thing that I like about these chapters here, as we're going through the manor and discovering all of the new stuff, right? Jason takes a shower and his clothes are absolutely destroyed, you know, through this whole ordeal. Basically, they're one mission clothes. They only lasted the first mission. Now they're gone. And as he's going through ransacking, trying to find clothes in his size, you know, finding outfits to wear, something that pointed out to me is really stuck out in the text. Everything but the t-shirt that he was wearing was unsalvageable, right? They all had to be thrown away. Nothing was safe except for the t-shirt. Right. And really, the t-shirt is the only bit of this entire ensemble that actually means anything. And this is the only piece of starting gear that actually stays with Jason throughout the entire series. You know, we see it a little bit in book 11. As far as I've read into book 12, we haven't seen it yet, but I assume he still has it in his inventory. It's like a memento from his first day in this world. The first thing that ever happens, the moment that changes his life. It's the only keepsake that he keeps through the entire series. And, you know, to us, it's like,
which quest was it again that he got the shirt for?
No shirt, no shoes, no service. So he got the quest for, he got the shirt as a reward for finding out why the lesser monsters have invaded the area, which
he completed by accident,
courtesy of Dougal.
Right, but by finding out that he was an accidental summon, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that also created a bunch of lesser monsters in the area that he had to fight. And so he accidentally completed the quest.
Right. But yeah, no, I was just seeing if it was connected to like one of the quests where he had to kill something and see if like it was specifically momentous like that. Got you.
Yeah.
So then I guess, he doesn't even save the dagger that he killed Landomir with. So he sells it, right?
Yeah, it's nice scale dagger. He keeps it at this point. Eventually he'll get rid of it. This is his like plus one dagger that he keeps for the majority of this book. I think until he gets his Blade of Tribulation ability. I think that's what it's called. The Ruined Blade of Tribulation. It's his summon dagger. When he gets his summon dagger, he gets rid of this dagger, I believe.
Got you. Interesting. Well, I mean, maybe that says a lot about Jason as a character, that he wouldn't keep, you know, his first murder weapon, but he would keep just some silly memento for like the craziest day of his life.
Yeah. And I am absolutely one of those players where if I'm in a sword and sorcery type video game, like as I'll get my starting gear, and then as soon as I get better gear, I'll switch it out. But the starting gear will always like remain in a chest somewhere. You know, my first of something will always just be saved somewhere I happen to be. I'm definitely one of those kinds of players, but I think it does say a lot about Jason. Like, he doesn't want to be the guy that remembers the day he killed someone for the first time. He wants to be the guy that remembers the day that changed his life.
Right. The day that he became a new him, essentially. Yeah.
Yes. Which leads us fantastically into the Rufus conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. And this conversation really gets into the meat of what it is to be an adventurer, as well as, you know, what, you know, Jason's immediate future may or may not look like.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Because Jason, they lay down for the night, you know, Jason's in this comfortable bed. And after having passed out, I believe 6 times at this moment, up until here, and being exhausted and punch drunk and completely out of it the entire time, you know, he's laying in bed, he cannot fall asleep, which we've all had those moments, you know, we're completely exhausted but we just can't sleep.
Right.
And he goes out, he looks at the night sky, you know, takes in everything that happened. You know, Rufus comes out, he's like, hey, you can't sleep, man, what's going on? They have the whole conversation. Rufus advises him, you know, what are you going to do? What's going on? You know, you can start a new life here. You can be the version of you you never got to be. You can start over, you know, which is a chance that not a lot of people get. You know, nobody knows him in this world. Nobody knows who he was, and none of it matters. He can be the person he always wanted to be and start from scratch right here. And the first step to doing that is to become an adventurer.
Right. And something that stood out to me in this was in his past life, you know, which, you know, is very relatable in general for just people in the modern day, but it's really relevant to us and our society because it's what we do. We escape into our movies and our TV and our video games. And, you know, here in the chapter itself, it's specifically said that, you know, monsters and myths are just metaphors in our world, stories we tell ourselves about the dark corners of our own nature.
Yes, and that's so beautiful.
It's so good. And it's, you know, like, it's just interesting that, you know, really, like, why is it that we feel the need to escape? And I mean, I think it's pretty easy that, you know, just the lives we built up and just the way of life we built up is not something we're really supposed to be doing as a creature. So we want to escape it. We want to live in these fantastical worlds of, you know, magic and this and that, but like, it's freedom that what we really want. It's the freedom to do and choose that we feel so limited by in our day-to-day lives. You know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely. You know, we as a species have created civilization, and that has become the prison that we live in. And really, everybody who goes through these phases of escapism, well, they do that because this prison, this imaginary prison that we built that is society, you know, has limited so much. It feels like we've lost all choice. And so it's easy to go into the movies, you know, and not have to exist in our own world for a couple hours. So that was a big thing with movies and the Great Depression. You know, people could go to the movies and not have to live through the Great Depression for a few hours. And that's where it comes from. You know, even in Jason's case, you know, he completely escaped his world. He put himself in a box in middle management. You know, he goes to work, he comes home, he plays video games, he goes to sleep, you know, and he,
right.
that is his life. You know, he's escaping social interaction and, you know, going out and doing something more because he feels like he can't.
Right. You know?
And this is the escape that forces him into a new life.
Right. And I feel like, you know, this series as a whole is a good metaphor for that, because more and more that lifestyle is becoming the prevalent lifestyle.
Yeah.
You know, as, you know, as people are growing up with technology, you know, more and more integrated into their lives, the outside world is a place to go and create content and then come back to the safeness of their digital world, you know?
Yeah.
And that sounds profound. Like, I don't mean to sound too profound. Bo Burnham said that. So he's the profound one, not me.
Yeah. Well, and we kind of see that play out in the book series too.
Yeah.
You know, in this moment, you know, Rufus gives Jason the choice. He can be the person he was, you know, go find something to do. He can go work as a cook in some random hotel in some village. So he can just be the kind of NPC lifestyle that he'd been living, or he can be something he's never been before. He can change his whole life. And, you know, later on when we get back to Earth, we see that really come back to him. That's the biggest fight he has when he gets back to Earth is, well, now he's back in the real world where people, you know who he was, and people have an idea of who he was. And he has to try and find a connection between the person that left and the person he became. You know,
right.
It's an extreme jolt. And that's, I feel like, what causes a lot of the issues for him. This moment, he decided to become better than he was. And then he goes back to a world that tries to force him to become what he used to be.
Right. And that, I think, is the allegory that is being made here on the whole as a series. And what I think Shirtalune is doing with this series. Because, you know, we've mentioned that, or I've mentioned that I think he is using this as a vehicle for moral philosophy in a way, in that we as people, we go through change and we go through growth, right? And sometimes we go off, you know, we move away from home or we do whatever and we go off and we become these new people. And then we have to go back to our old worlds and really try to navigate our old world as these new people and realize that, you know, you're not from that old world anymore. And I really think that that's what he's trying to say on the whole with this series. It's, you know, that as you grow and change as a person, what you knew isn't going to be what you know anymore. The world you once lived in is no longer the world you live in. And no matter how hard you try, the more you grow as a person, and by growing as a person, I'm talking about the concerted effort to better yourself as a person, right? You know, which I think on the whole is the point of moral philosophy is, well, maybe, but I think that's the point they want you to think, is that, you know, you should be bettering yourself and finding, you know, finding deeper versions of yourself. But when you do, the world you know and knew goes away, you know, and
yeah,
and it's going to look completely different when you try to revisit it.
Yes. Oh, for sure. And we'll get into it a little bit more when we get to books 3 and 4 and 5. We can really break it down and look at it. On the whole, I'd just like to say the study of philosophy at this point, it's just kind of niche, eh?
That's going to be the end of this podcast as a whole. No.
I really hate to ruin a discussion like that, but I had to.
You can't not.
But getting back down to the chapters that we're covering here a little bit.
Sure.
Kind of rounding it back in. but yeah, that is the choice that Jason has to make now, you know, and the choice that he's discussing with Rufus And, you know, Rufus says overall it's your choice, you know, but if you really do want to become the person that you never could, the first step would be to become an adventurer like us, you know. And similar to when he offered to find essences for Jason, you know, obviously he already has some. So his next proposal, you know, we'll get you some essences. And then he offers to train Jason. He's like, we'll train you. We'll show you how to do it. Which, as we know now, you know, reading through it, that is not an offer to ever refuse. And that is what Farrah tells us a little bit later. You know, the Rufus Remore is offering to train you. You don't say no. You know, you will be an adventurer.
Yeah, I mean, if this was, you know, if this was the music industry and you were a guitarist, you know, this is like Zach Wilde being like, you got what it takes. I'm going to train you. You don't tell Zach Wilde no.
No. And it was so nonchalant, too. He's like, well, what do I do if I want to be an adventurer? And Rufus goes, well, we can show you, you know, we just offhanded, we can show you how to be an adventurer. And what he's really saying is, like, I will personally train you to be an adventurer, which is a massive deal. But to them, you know, in this situation, we know Jason doesn't have a lot of respect for authority in general. And Rufus doesn't really see himself as a big deal in the adventuring world, which is why I feel like this combination of people really works out.
Dude, that's a good point. Because, yeah, like, even though Rufus actually really can be an authority figure, and we see it a lot later when you really see him training Jason and training other people, he can be a bit serious and like he doesn't mess around, and the circle he runs in doesn't mess around either, because one of his friends, you know, we'll find out later in this book, is the instructor, and they have very similar no-nonsense attitudes.
Oh yeah.
But as they're discussing all of this, Jason is like not sure about this. He's real hesitant because he's just done a lot of killing, and it's like it's not sitting well with him. And he's like, yo, like this is a hard thing to do. This is crazy. Like, I don't know if I can do this.
Yes,
he literally says, you know, the last time I was in a fight, I was 10 years old or it had been 10 years ago.
One or the other. Yeah.
10 years ago. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Children's fight for children's reasons. And this, you know, brings us to like probably one of the biggest, like, go get 'em, but also get off your ass kind of speeches. And Shirtaloon is really good at doing stuff like this. And this speech, it is absolutely intense.
It is. And this is one of those things that I feel like Jason takes to heart and stays with him, because he references this speech throughout the entire series. You know, this becomes his attitude. You know, we start out, Rufus is like, you know, this is not the first night of sleep you're going to lose over taking a life. You know, I've lost sleep over it. You know, you don't think I do this easily. I don't. You don't think I lose sleep. I don't. But it has to be done, and I'm the one that does it. You know, and I actually have the words here, if you wouldn't mind, so that we can absolutely all experience. Even if you haven't read the series, you're just here for the vibes. This is really the attitude that Jason tries to inhabit throughout the entire series and does a really good job of, I think. This is what Rufus says. He says, I'm an adventurer. Being an adventurer can open every door, give you everything you ever wanted. Power, money, respect, travel the world, see amazing things. 9 days out of 10, being an adventurer is the best thing you could possibly be. But on that 10th day, that's the one where you earn all the others, when you make the hard choices, when you walk through fire so that no one else has to. You know, and that is just the ultimate hero speech, I think, because that embodies the ideal, you know, sacrifice of oneself. Like, yes, I have power. Yes, I have money. I can do whatever I want, you know, but on that 10th day, you got to stand and you've got to earn everything that you just got. Because when everybody else, it reminds me a lot of, you know, like firefighters' attitudes. You know, when you're coming up on a burning building, you know, being a firefighter is cool. You know, you get a lot of respect doing it. And, you know, you get all of this social credit, you know, but when it matters, you know, you show up to a burning building and everybody is running out. That's the moment that you run in, because 100%. You're the one that's going in there to save everybody else.
And actually, shortly, just a couple paragraphs before that, you get Rufus mentioning how there's a call, like kind of a call of, you know, call to action or call of duty here. And actually, it's really cool because if you know the hero's journey chart, this is literally like this whole section, this whole conversation with Rufus is the call to action. This yes. is like in the hero's journey wheel, like this is the call to action. And Jason, talking about how his world is safe, and Rufus is like, you have to accept that you're not there anymore. This world is hard and life can be cheap. And then he talks about how, you know, like the Cannibal Kitchen, he talks about how that if they hadn't stopped those cannibals, they were going to keep doing it. So, you know, it's a moral gray area, because it's like, well, yeah, we killed someone, but they were going to kill a lot more people if we hadn't done that.
Right. Like, think of all of the people that they already killed. You know, how many decades or centuries have they been doing that? And how many decades or centuries would they have kept doing that if we didn't step in? You know, we killed 15, 20 people. They've killed hundreds, you know, sure. And it had to be done. You know, in Jason's world, it could be as easy as calling the police and getting somebody arrested, but that's not an option here. You know, yeah, the metaphor that I like to draw.
Adventurers are the police.
They are the police, but they would be more like the National Guard than your local law enforcement.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, it's like when you're dealing with a group of people who all have the power of nuclear weapons, you know, you need the person that knows how to use your nukes wisely to neutralize it. You know, that's the power level that we're dealing with in terms of Jason's world versus this world.
Right.
Kind of just how I view it. You know, like, yeah, Jason's world has people who are bad, but they can be taken down a peg. You know, in this world, as we've seen, you know, these are almost silver rank adventurers trained at the Remora Academy, and they were ambushed and captured. You know, this is like SEAL Team 6 getting captured. So whoever they're up against is like your normal SEAL Team 6 on SEAL Team 6 action. And when everybody's a SEAL, you need a better SEAL to take care of it.
When everybody's a SEAL, SEAL
way too many times.
When everybody's a SEAL, no one is.
You got to be the Orca, baby. I don't know. Oh, but yeah, man. that is the moral dilemma that Jason struggles with, you know, for several books. And this is the kicking off point. And this is right in that speech. You know, Rufus says you can be the one who's safe in their beds, or you can be the one that ensures everybody else is safe in their beds. If you want to control your own destiny, you become an adventurer.
Yeah, absolutely. And in that whole section, one of my favorite parts there, Jason asks, is it worth it? Mm-hmm. And Rufus is like, only you can answer that. You save lives today, mine included. But he had to stay in his hands. And he says, if you got to remake those choices, would you do it all again? And at the moment, Jason does not know, because this is a big thing. This is a big day. And essentially, so wrapping up chapter 18, Jason asks Rufus, like, well, what do I need to do? And he says, well, you got to have some essences. And yeah. That's the starting point. And we'll give them to you.
Yeah.
And then the line, before everything else, adventurers are strong.
Yes, they are. Which is kind of a weird thought experiment on my side, right? So Jason already has the essences, right? So it's not like he would need the essences specifically to be an adventurer. Chances are they were going to tell him to absorb the essences anyway, because having essences puts a leg up in this world, gives you the ability to live longer and actually commit to society. So, you know, even if he wasn't going to be an adventurer, having the essences will make him a valued asset in society, you know?
Right.
But I think the way it's phrased up here is kind of Rufus leading him on. So it's like whatever choice he made, he was going to absorb the essences anyway. But like Rufus is like, yeah, if you want to be an adventurer, you need those. Hmm. And so it's like by absorbing those, it's like a subconscious, well, now I'm going to be an adventurer because I have the option, you know? Just some thought experiment on my end of it.
Yeah, that's a really good point. It provoked a lot of thought in me, I'll tell you that. Because one thing, for no reason, just out of nowhere, while you were saying that, it occurred to me, like, I had a passing thought about, like, you know, like, yeah, you're right. Like, having essences does make it work, you know, worth being. Even your most common baker and butcher probably have essences. And then I realized, like, well, but there's still, like, normal rankers that exist. And then it kind of hit me that that's probably, like, the poverty class.
Yeah.
And there's probably, like, a whole lot of class war stuff going on that we don't see or hear about, really.
I think there is, too. You know, because we see, it's like when we get to the first town, for the life of me, I can't remember his name, but we'll find out in a little bit. It's like when Jason goes up to the waterfall, the dude who's in charge of keeping the waterfall secure is only in that position because he already has an essence. You know, right. he's got a power, and so he's automatically given an option of jobs that normal rankers without essences wouldn't have.
Right. You know,
and I do believe that's the case, especially in a low magic zone like this. If you don't have any essences, you're the lowest of the low. You know, you can still do a lot of things. You can still build up, but it's a lot harder to make that kind of a life for yourself without the essences, which is what we do see a lot of people saving up to buy essences for their children so that their children can have a better life. You know, it's not something you're going to see in your lifetime, but all of your money is going into giving your children those essences so that they don't have to be poor and they don't have to be normal rank the entire time.
Right. It's like that struggle of like working hard to break that generational poverty kind of.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like saving up every ounce of money you make so that your son or your daughter can go to college. It would be our equivalent of it, you know, so that they can have a life that you don't have. It's the same thing just with essences.
And it's crazy because due to Jason's like the way he was brought into this world, as well as who he was picked up by and the circle he got into, he doesn't really get to experience the nitty gritty low side of this world, the struggle side of this world. Essentially, the minute he's in this world, things like money and essences are just givens. They don't even matter to him.
Right. Like, right? He definitely got a good bit of luck here.
He really did. And obviously, we know that there was a lot of other forces at play that put him specifically in these situations to, you know, further other plans and whatnot. But I think that also speaks well to his character, because even without seeing the low side of the society, he still cares for the low side of society. We see that with Belinda and Sophie. They are poverty-stricken thieves with just a couple essences between them.
Yeah.
And
well, and I think he does see a lot of the impoverished side of it, just not experiences it himself, and we don't see a lot of it in the books, because we know he spends a lot of time with common folk. You know,
right.
He cooks a lot. He spends a lot of time in villages with random people, and he gets to see a lot of it. He just never gets to experience it. So I think it's one of those, like I'm taking a tour of the countryside. I've got all of the money that I need, but these people out here don't. And he does a lot to help them,
mm-hmm.
you know. And I feel like it's one of those things where he sees it but doesn't embody it. And that's why it doesn't feel like we see it as the reader. So we don't really take it to mean like that, because that's not how Jason is seeing it himself.
Right. He's just seeing them as the people. And he's kind of, you know, shoehorned himself in as a protector without him realizing it, you know, even right here at the beginning of the book, you know, beginning of the series, he's protecting people who in all regards should be saving him.
Yeah.
But he's doing all this stuff on his own. Like he just has that in his nature.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's crazy.
But the funny thing about this and getting into chapter 19, he has kind of a fake it till you make it attitude, because as the team is gathered around and kind of discussing, you know, all right, well, Jason thinks he wants to do this, become, you know, do essences and whatnot. And they start really discussing about what they're going to do with essences. And a conversation between him and Farrah, you know, he's talking and he's like, oh, so how many essences do I get? And she's like, you know, 4. Man, I keep forgetting you really don't know anything, because he's talking with knowledge in certain aspects, but then in others, you know, has zero knowledge of even basic common knowledge.
Yeah, and I had picked that out too. She's like, well, 4 makes a set, and he's like, I've only got 3, and she's like, yeah, that's enough. I keep forgetting. And it's like, well, actually,
that's right.
Yeah. And I'm like, I had written him down. I compared him to like the drunk guy at the party that is like acts well enough that people just assume he's sober. He's got that guy knows what he's doing. He's got to be the sober one, even when he's drunk, you know.
Sure.
This fair is like walking around. It's the same thing. Fake it till you make it. But it's like fair just keeps forgetting that he's completely ignorant of everything, even after she learned that he's from another world. Mm-hmm. It's like, wait a minute. It's just that utter confidence that he exudes, and the
right.
random nonsense that he blurts out. She's like, just assumes he knows the basic stuff, even though he doesn't. He's really good at that. Let's see. I don't know. I had it written down. Is it just that he's good at hiding his ignorance? Or is this just like an intentional strong suit of his?
I really want to believe that it's hiding that he's not. I won't get into spoilers, but there's a conversation with a character in book 12 about pretty much exactly this, where he's talking like, oh man, I was so nervous the last time we talked, and like, you did not seem nervous at all. And he's like, yeah, you know, like just how it is. Like, I just do my thing, you know. No, it's 100%. It's a fake it till you make it. Even if he is shaking in his boots, he's still probably going to make some dumbass joke and, you know, flip you off. Like, that's just how Jason Asano is going to be.
Oh yeah. Totally. Well, let's talk about some essences and some magic.
Yes. Now, before we get too far ahead in that, you mentioned about the 3 essences being enough for 4 essences.
Yes.
So that in the series is called a confluence essence, right?
Yeah.
And so before we get breaking down what he can do with essences and all the other fun stuff, I just had a little fun piece of stuff that I wanted to bring in. What the word confluence even means. Because when I first read it, I never encountered the word, and I was like, I don't know what confluence even means.
Interesting.
So I looked at the etymology, and it comes from the Latin word confluere. Meaning with, and fluere meaning flow together. So those three essences will flow together into a fourth essence, a confluence, a essence that flows together.
Yeah.
That's really cool. It's just a neat bit of etymology, and I thought it would be fun.
No, that is really cool. And that is what they do too. They, you know, when we see it later on, we'll get into it later on, but they literally flow together to form one confluence essence. We get to see that play out.
Mm-hmm.
It's really cool. What I really enjoy about essences in general, you know, the whole idea behind an essence is a physical manifestation of the ideal that they're embodying, you know, like right. with Jason's dark essence, it's, you know, the magical embodiment of what darkness means. And with Farrah's essences, you know, she's got the earth essence, which is the essence of what earth is, the fire essence, which is the essence of what fire is. So she's got heat and earth. And then the potent essence is more of the ideal of potency itself, whether that be power or strength or, you know, overall, for lack of a better term, potency.
Right.
But then when you flow all of those together, you combine the meanings of all of those, her confluence became volcano, you know, so a really? Volcano in essence is earth and fire mixed with power and strength and potency. And so it's explosive lava.
It's a potent fiery earth.
Yeah, it is. And that's what we see a lot. You know, Jason's essences get a little, I guess, creative with what it is. But
right.
Because that's what I love about the idea of essences. It's like taking the meaning that we as a society have deemed something is and making it physical.
Sure. And now, I guess we'll get more in depth into what Jason's confluences and all that, and all just in general, what his essences are in the next one.
Yeah.
But a comment I had just about, I guess, just keeping for me on the theme about like real world allegory. They mentioned that like strong powers create a strong appetite, right?
Mm.
And I felt that it was, you know, because we were talking about, you know, lava powers and this and that. And, you know, Jason's kind of pining about how like, oh, well, you know, I want big, crazy powers. And they're like, yeah, you know, well, you get big, crazy powers, you're going to end up with a big, crazy appetite. In specific, they're talking about the vampiric life drain ability.
Yeah, a little bit here, yeah.
Yeah. And for me, it kind of translated, like, that sentence right there, like, the strong powers creating a strong appetite, you know, kind of viewed, like, to my mind as, like, an allegory for capitalism, or at least it could be, you know, compared in that way. With these strong powers, you know, in capitalistic, with a lot of money, you get an appetite for more money. In this world, you have a lot of power, you have an appetite for more power. And we actually see Jason kind of adopt that power hungry in a way kind of thing. So, you know, maybe on that allegory, it's another possibility. I'm always trying to think of it like that with this series.
I think it's yes and no. You know, Jason's crave for power doesn't come from the fact that he has a lot of power. It specifically comes from the fact that he has no power in a world true. That needs him to be powerful. You know,
I think we mentioned this before.
We did, yeah. And with Farrah's abilities, you know, all of her abilities are strong, powerful abilities. And she runs out of mana really quick, but she doesn't really have the need or the strive for more power in that sense. And we talk a little bit here about, you know, essences changing who you are, which is, it's a little bit in the next chapter here. We can get into it a little bit later more. But we see with the vampiric appetite in particular, we're talking about the restricted essences and, you know, why some essences are deemed unacceptable by modern society. This is where we get a little bit of that bleed through with, you know, a moral decision or a societal decision versus a natural one, you know, because you have the undeath essence and the death essence are the top of the list of restricted. And, you know, in basic, you know, if we think of them as just essences and just magical, they're not inherently good or bad. You know, a death essence is just the essence of being dead. And an undeath is the opposite of that, similar to how fire and water are. But the abilities that are gained from these essences, like death and undeath or blood, creating vampires, you know, and the way that they interact with society as a whole, you know, has been deemed unacceptable. Like, there's no way a vampire could be accepted into normal society because of the ideas of what they deem moral and immoral versus the way a vampire is in essence.
Right.
And it's a weird bleed through. It's like, to, you know, the meanings of these things made manifest in magic becomes what morals are.
Yeah, that is 100% accurate. And I think Chertalun just has a really interesting way of viewing things like that, where he can take a moral lesson and wrap it up in the concept of a vampire and then hand it to you like a nice little book with a bow on it. And you're just like, aw, this is neat. And then all the while you're like, am I learning to be a better person?
Right. Well, we see that even with the vampire talk, you know, on Palamustis, where vampires are, you know, able to become, you know, silver rank, gold rank and beyond. And they become powerful enough, you know, they're just a horrible thing to have in general. But we go back to Earth and vampires are a thing. You know, we meet Craig Vermillion. He's not at all the kind of vampire that you would see on Palamustis. Because his appetites are satiable at a lower level. You know, vampires are a big deal at gold rank because they need more than just a little bit of blood here and there to survive. You know, it's the same way that a diamond ranker would not be a good idea in like Greenstone. Diamond ranker goes to Greenstone, absorbs all of the mana. Now it's a magic mana desert, you know? Right. And if you have enough of that happening, I'd imagine the view on gold rankers would be very similar, because they wouldn't be able to survive without stealing the magic from everybody else.
Right.
The same way vampires wouldn't be able to survive without stealing the blood from everybody else.
You know, and one other thing that can be said, though, about the difference here between Palamustis and Earth in regards to that vampire thing, though, is on Palamustis, it is vampires are a very known thing, and it is a very kill on sight kind of thing.
Yeah.
Earth, they are running around in secret, operating blood banks, making lots of money, and like having a whole society underground. You know, so that alone could help. I mean, despite just the magic differences, just having the ability, because I mean, I thought Vermillion was gold rank, or is he silver rank?
I think he was bronze rank originally when we met him.
I guess the power difference. I'm guessing when we met him, Jason was still like either low bronze, high iron, or low bronze.
He was low bronze because he reached bronze in the astral space, and then like the whole team reached bronze, and then he got killed and reincarnated. So he was the very start of bronze when he got back to Earth.
Mm. That's right. That's right. Oh yeah, because Vermilion's on Earth, so obviously.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, that's a bronze rank arc. I guess that's why I thought he was just a higher rank, because Jason just tends to deal with people much higher than him, always.
Yeah. Always.
All right. So now we are getting pretty close to the end of our time. So before we get into the next episode, where we're going to really be talking about essences in depth, today was a little more in talk just about what it is to be an adventurer and moral choices. But there's one thing in chapter 19 that I really thought was just a fun, interesting thing. When they're looking up essences and they're looking up combinations, and we'll get into this more in the next episode, Farah procures a tablet. It's like a living document, or she calls it the living document. And it's like a quickly updated reference, like immediately updated reference list of, you know, all the possible combinations of, you know, essences that are good, bad, whatever, maybe just the whole essence compendium.
Yeah, and basically an index.
An index, right. But in my mind, I'm like, hold up. This is Palamustis Internet, and they're just, they don't see it yet. They don't realize what they've got on their hands. Like, yo, you've got the internet already. Yeah. You're not even thinking about it. Like they could have Twitter just rocking and rolling.
Right. I had written that down too. Like, they have the internet, but they don't have cell phones. Like, at the very least, like, I'd imagine it's like a updates overnight kind of thing that we would see. And I'm sure that the central record is massive in terms of magical array that they have to deal with. The way I see it, you know, you have one master circuit, I guess, that gets updated, and then the rest of them get updated from there. So it's only one way. But even then, I feel like they could use that same technology for a lot of different things.
They could, but I feel like I think maybe one thing we might be viewing wrong is we're just viewing it through a technological mindset. So in our eyes, we're like, well, that makes sense. You could do stuff with that. But in their mind, they might not even think to do something like that, because there's other methods to accomplish the other stuff they want to get done anyway.
Right. That's fair. I mean, and having the water link system that they do have is kind of the default. So I can see them seeing this as like, well, this is just how we update this record. It's just the way we do it.
Right.
I feel like, though, at some point down the line, somebody would have been like, hey, what if every adventure society has like a chalkboard that we can use to send bulletins to everybody else?
Or and then why don't we have every adventurer just carry around a little device, and they can just see what jobs are available for their rank and just accept jobs?
Right. Instead of going out to the Delta, clearing a contract, coming all the way back, getting another one, going out to the Delta. I could see a logistical issue being only updated one way. So like, if you could see what contracts are available but not be able to accept them or complete them from your tablet, you just have a bunch of people running around the desert looking for contracts that somebody else already completed, and then they wouldn't know until that one person got all the way back into town to update the record.
Right.
So it'd be a small logistical issue in that regard.
Well, and that's only if they couldn't figure out a way to make it two-way. But I feel like they could.
Yeah.
Like, if you can make it one-way, why can't you make it two-way? You know?
The only thing I can think of is a massive magical array that needs to be in place to be able to update every tablet that's attached to it.
Sure.
So it's like if you need a bank of 70 servers to be able to send one message to one tablet, that wouldn't be convenient to carry with you in the desert.
Well, that's okay. That's facts. But at the same time, it also sounds like you just described a cell phone network. But
yes, but I guess cell phone networks, you don't have to carry the antenna with you. You just connect to the antenna, which is not a thing that they thought of until Travis. I don't know. Put that on the list of things to ask Shirtaloon. Because you would think there's a way to make that work, that somebody would have had the idea, at the very least, from headquarters to headquarters, to be able to communicate with other adventure societies outside of Waterlink, especially during a monster surge.
Right. Like, you would think.
Like, instead of having a team of teleporters and portal specialists available to just run messages, have like every outpost have one of those updating boards, like, hey, we need supplies, and then use those portal specialists to portal to those destinations.
Right.
Save an entire trip.
Yeah, you could cut down on a whole lot of portaling just by like literally at that point. I don't think the array system would be so insane that you couldn't just have them all over the place.
I mean, it would have to be. Otherwise, have them all over the place.
Well, okay, it's one of two things then. It's either a plot hole, or the people of Halmustis just genuinely didn't think to do this.
I'm going to choose to believe it's a plot hole because I haven't found any yet, and it would be nice to have one.
All right. Well, we found one.
They can
make things a lot more efficient if they just utilize the internet that they seemingly have.
Yeah. At the very least, Jason be like, hey, isn't that like the internet? And then just breaks reality. Like, hey, this is all the stuff we can do. Can you do that?
Yeah, knowledge would not let that happen.
No. He would have been smited. Smited? Smitten? Smited. Smote. He would have been smote down before he even got essences.
And I'd be like, no.
You don't know me yet, but you're gonna die. Okay. Well, we will get into essences and magic and awakening stones and even gods in the next episode.
Yes, we will. But it's been a good one today.
It has been. This has been just a fun episode to do. We got to look at the conversations between Rufus and Jason, the way that we kind of view this new world. We talk a little bit about moral philosophy. Always a good time. Oh. And stay tuned for a moon demonstration where we try and figure this out. Because physics.
If we maybe remember to do it.
We'll remember. This is going to haunt me the rest of my life.
Yeah, probably will. Yeah. Stay tuned for that moon demonstration, folks.
Stay tuned.
All right. Well, until next time, I've been D. Allen.
I have been Donnie B. Make sure, if you're not following us already, to go ahead and give us a follow on YouTube, Facebook, X, TikTok, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Absolutely. Until next time.